Welcome to the Faith Element Podcast for August 16, 2015, for session 7.33, focusing on the text from 1 Kings chapter 2, verse 1 through chapter 3, verse 15, The Wisest Fool. I'm David Cassidy, and I'm joined today for this episode by Nikki Hardiman, Daniel Glaze, and Bert Montgomery. Bert, can you please give us an introduction to today's focal passage?
I sure can. Thank you, David. In this section from 1 Kings, we've been talking on the last couple of podcasts about King David. And today, King David is dying. And it's like he's passing the mantle on to one of his sons, Solomon. Just note that that's his son that is born by Bathsheba. And David does the good parental thing. He says, Solomon, you know, here's what you need to do. You need to keep all of God's commandments, keep all of his requirements, obey all the laws of Moses, and then you'll be successful in all things that you do. And then David goes on, and again, I quoted this a few weeks ago, but it's like watching The Godfather. David sits there and he says, but in essence, Solomon, there's some family business you need to wrap up. So he tells him to take care of unsettled family business, and he talks about Joab, who killed his son Absalom that we had just talked about in a previous episode. And he says, now look, do what, I love this verse, it's in verse 6. Well, I don't love it, it's terrible. But in verse 6, he says, do what you think best, Solomon, but don't let him grow old and don't let him go to his grave in peace. You know, so kind of give him that clue. And then he mentions another enemy that David had once swore by the Lord he would never kill. So, David, I can never kill him. I mean, Solomon, I can never kill him. But you know how to arrange a bloody death for him, is what the scripture says. So he's kind of telling him, take care of family business. So really get the Godfather thing going. And if that's not enough, then Solomon has to deal with his brother, who was a competitor for the throne and thought he should rightfully get it. Solomon's in charge now. The brother, Adonijah, comes in and can't even see his own brother. So he's got to go get permission, and he goes to get permission from Bathsheba, Solomon's mother, his stepmother, if you will. They probably hate each other, to ask for a favor, and please don't refuse me. But then, of course, Absalom says, well, you know, whatever, and he has him killed. So it's just, it's a bloody mess, and it's a continuation of the tragedy of everything that had been going on in David's family that we've already been talking about the last few weeks. Then Solomon has a dream. Solomon's fully in charge now, and he has a dream. And God asks him what he wants, and he tells God, this is what I want. I want wisdom. I want an understanding heart. And God grants it to him. Then we go on later, and we know all about Solomon, and he did great things. He's known for wisdom. He's credited with writing Ecclesiastes, Proverbs, and the Song of Solomon, and all the wise sayings and the things he did in court. And he rebuilt the temple, and he had all this extravagance, and he was building things, and some people were extremely wealthy, including him and his hundreds and hundreds of wives, which was pretty costly, and he neglected or he abused and exploited many people in his kingdom for this wealth and for this power. And he was ruthless, as we've seen. He had his own brother killed, and this kind of thing. And I'm thinking about, when I'm reading this, and we know about Solomon, we think of Solomon being all wise. Walter Brueggemann, the Old Testament historian, notes that there's no reason why we should doubt that Solomon had this dream in which he asked God for wisdom, and God grants him wisdom, and God grants him an understanding heart. And Solomon lets everybody know this, because then obviously God is blessing Solomon to rule. There's no reason to doubt that. But we also have no reason, knowing what we know about Solomon, especially looking back, to think that maybe it wasn't something, a political motivation. Solomon wanted it to get out there that God had chosen him, because every ruler likes the people to know that God chose me. God spoke to me. God's called me. I mean, just think of everybody who's running for president right now. And so we get that. And Brueggemann notes that with all the greed and with all the wealth, he distorts the wisdom that God gave him. He abuses it so that his heart, Brueggemann writes, is no longer listening to God, and it's no longer understanding. And Brueggemann adds, God-given wisdom in the Hebrew scriptures is not successful management, it's not clever rulings, it's not a flourishing economy or technological mastery, but rather, God-given wisdom is attentiveness to the socially and economically vulnerable. And Frederick Buechner, if I can quote him, says a lot of the same type of stuff about Solomon and his extreme extreme personalities and all the wealth and the power and the greed and all this, but then also the tragedy and the abuse. And he says that Solomon was one of the wisest fools who ever ruled a kingdom. So putting wisdom and foolishness together at the same time. And again, I think you would agree with Brueggemann because of the way he left the kingdom unsustainable. And as Buechner says, before he's even cold in his grave, the kingdom is split. So that's Solomon.
All these Old Testament kings are such bigger than life characters. You've got David who does everything big, and Solomon does not fall far from that tree. He's full of extravagance. But I do think it's really interesting that we connect him so much to wisdom in the Bible, and that he's credited with writing Ecclesiastes and some of Proverbs, at least. And of course, we give him credit for Song of Songs, so much so that we've changed the name of that text to be Song of... We call it Song of Solomon, but it's not. The text, it's called Song of Songs. And so we have given him so much credit for this wisdom. And it's directly because of this passage that we're looking at, this dream that happens when he asks for wisdom and God grants the wisdom. And it causes me to reflect on this idea of what is wisdom called in Scripture. The interesting thing is the very first people to be called to fear God in the Bible are the midwives who save the little babies from being killed by Pharaoh in Egypt. Those are the first two people in the Bible to be told that they fear the Lord. And when we get all the way into Psalms and Proverbs, what we hear is the beginning of wisdom is the fear of God. It's the fear of the Lord. And we all know this isn't a fear where we stand terrified. It's more the word really means that we have awe, reverence, respect for God. And so Scripture puts forth this idea that wisdom is about an awareness of the bigness of God. And for me, I think that there's two sides to that. One, it means if I'm going to have wisdom, I have to know that I'm not the most powerful thing there is. And two, I also have to know that I'm not alone, that I don't have to do this on my own, that God is there to support and be with and to hold and to help. And I think, you know, we can come at it from both sides, but was Solomon wise in that way? I don't know. What do you think? Was Solomon wise according to that biblical definition?
Yeah, I'm not so sure according by the biblical definition in which we just spoke about the fear of the Lord, because it seems like he did believe that, you know, hey, he's the king and he's all powerful and he's got all the wealth, and that maybe he had lost the sense of there's someone greater and lost a sense of humility. Which was, again, going back to some of the other discussions we've had in previous weeks, was David's problem too. You know, it was good to be the king. He could do whatever he wanted, and he did.
Yeah, and I as you said, Nikki, you know, that part of being wise is having the fear of the Lord, and you rightfully point out how that is perhaps better understood as recognizing that, recognizing our place before God and recognizing God's supremacy, I guess. And the flip side, you know, to knowing that God is God is realizing that we are not. You know, but as I said in a sermon recently, it's a somewhat difficult thing for me to think about, you know, that on the one hand, God wants to be as close to us as our next breath, but this God is also the creator of the universe. Mm-hmm. And knowing that rightful place, is, I guess I'm not wise because I still have not gotten that figured out yet. But understanding that rightful place, I think really speaks to me in terms of what wisdom is all about, and shows me how these characters, you know, that we've referred to as wise, even struggled with that.
You know, I like to think that at the beginning Solomon was wise. I think we obviously see him do some really great things. We all know the story of the two prostitutes who bring the baby, and they're arguing over who the baby belongs to, and Solomon, in all of his wisdom, says, you know, cut the baby in half. And I always wonder, would he have really done it? Would he have gone through with it? But I don't know that it matters, because it affected what needed to be affected. It made it happen, and they figured out who the baby belonged to, and justice was served in an incredibly creative way. And so I like to think that Solomon really was wise at some point. But we also know that when we look at his story, things go downhill pretty fast. I talk in the video for Faith Element about how Solomon was the last king of the United Kingdom, and so really Israel is united as one for only three kings: Saul, David, and Solomon. And then after that, it splits into the Northern Kingdom and Southern Kingdom, and all of that happens really as a result of Solomon's reign. Solomon spent way more money building than he should have. There's evidence that he utilized the vulnerable and the poor in his nation for slave labor to make his building projects happen, both the temple and the palace. And then we see that the temple took 7 years to build and the palace took like 13 years to build. So we certainly see an imbalance of probably the way things should have been. And then what we also know, and what Solomon is incredibly well known for, are all of his wives and concubines. And there's so many of them, and they're not Israelite. Most of them come from other lands. And when they come from other lands, they bring with them the gods that they worship. And Solomon allowed that to run rampant. He allowed them to worship their gods in the temple. And it just created an ethos that was... it was harmful to the kingdom. And so he had just a lot of things in place that made it impossible to sustain the kingdom. And so then it ended up, shortly after he died, the kingdom splits. And a lot of that is because of Solomon and his unwise actions as a ruler. Something that I've always found interesting: Saul had Samuel, and David had Nathan, and Solomon didn't have a prophet that was whispering in his ear. Solomon didn't have anybody who was saying, hey, keep this in check. This is what God says. We never hear, we don't have a prophet for Solomon who's whispering in his ear. And I guess it makes me think... you know, I think that a lot of us understand the wisdom that we have because of people in our lives. I think that a lot of times there are people in our lives who help us learn the things that we need to learn. And any of the wisdom that we can collect comes from those people who are talking to our Nathans and our Samuels.
That's really interesting, Nikki, that I hadn't thought of it that way, but I think you're exactly right that, you know, that wisdom may not be original concept, but is inherited or soaked up from those around us. There's a wonderful gentleman in my church who I just adore, and he's I would call him very wise. He's a great gardener, and sort of a Renaissance man, a great gardener, great cook. He makes the most delicious collard greens you ever put in your mouth. And I remember one time I asked him, "Mr. Al, I really need the recipe for your collard greens." And he said, 50 cents a collards and $5 a ham. And and I thought, you know what, the man's right. But I one time I asked him, Al, you're incredibly wise and a great counsel to me. Where did you get this wisdom? And he told me very plainly, son, I've made a lot more mistakes than you have. Those life experiences had contributed, I think, to the wisdom he had gained, and I still am a recipient of Al's wisdom.
Yeah. When we talk about wisdom in that sense, and the book of Proverbs, attributed to Solomon, right? The book of Proverbs refers to wisdom in a very personal sense. I mean, like, literally, here's this person named Wisdom. She's a woman, and she was with God from the very beginning, before the oceans were made, before anything was put in the sky. Lady Wisdom was there with God. And in Proverbs 7, it talks about an immoral woman. Now, Proverbs, we just got it, so I'm being sexist or anything. Proverbs was written in ancient Israel for young men, for young men to make wise decisions. So it's written in that sense. So there's this immoral woman in chapter 7 who is very, very flattering and has a beautiful countenance and is just would to seduce anybody, and very seductively dressed, but just so gently leads young men into her deathbed, is what Proverbs calls it, right? And very much like a House of the Rising Sun, it's she's been the ruin of many a poor boy, and which always makes me think of New Orleans. When I read Solomon, when I read Proverbs about wisdom there, and then chapter 8 comes back with when the immoral woman in 7, and then chapter 8 has woman Wisdom, who is walking the same streets, in the same marketplaces, on the same corners with the immoral woman, calling out. So New Orleans is my frame of reference because that's where I grew up. And my dad has this great story that he told us. He waited till I was an adult to tell me this. But when he was a student at Tulane University, there was a pep rally on campus. Back in the late 50s, Tulane was pretty good in football, and they were part of the Southeastern Conference. People don't remember that. And there was a big game coming up. David remembers. There was a big game coming up against another Southeastern Conference foe at the time, Georgia Tech, who was always pretty good in football. It was a huge game, so there's this pep rally going on Tulane's campus on a Friday night before the game on Saturday. And when the pep rally comes to a close, all these enthusiastic students, including my father, jump in their cars and form a caravan and parade from uptown all the way down to Bourbon Street, and are driving down Bourbon Street, which you could do at the time, and honking their horns and hanging out the windows, waving Tulane banners, and no doubt chanting and screaming at Georgia Tech fans, soaking in Bourbon Street culture before the game. And the police started pulling over some of the drivers, and my dad was one of the drivers who got pulled out and arrested, if you can believe this, for disturbing the peace on Bourbon Street, of all places. But he was arrested. He was arrested on the corner of Bourbon and Toulouse Street. And Toulouse is notorious for a history of brothels. So he's on the corner of Bourbon and Toulouse Street, and there's a nightclub, a world-famous nightclub called the 500 Club. It's not there now, but you can Google New Orleans 500 Club and get pictures of what it looked like back in the 50s and 60s. World famous, and had world famous exotic dancers. And one of the ones that came around on a regular basis was a woman named Lily the Cat Christine. and they had huge posters. So my dad tells me about the time he got arrested on the corner of Bourbon and Toulouse and encountered Lily the cat Christine, this exotic dancer. And what happened was when they pulled him out of the car and said, put your hands up on the wall, he's facing the club with his hands on images of Lily the cat Christine. Which is hilarious. Because my dad was a Baptist deacon at St. Charles Avenue Baptist Church. And it's just hilarious to remember. But I tell that story because my dad was one of the wisest men who ever lived. And growing up in New Orleans, Dad never hid New Orleans culture for good and for bad from us. We went to Mardi Gras parades, and I don't just mean Mardi Gras parades out in the suburbs where all the families were. We did those, and those could be raunchy too. But he took us to Mardi Gras parades in New Orleans, and we walked around the French Quarter, and we saw life as it was. And he never hid that from us, but he always taught us to make good choices and taught us, you know, this is what's out here, but you don't have to do this. You can acknowledge it. You can know it's here, as opposed to protecting us. Because a lot of times as Christians, we want to withdraw and pretend the world isn't out there. And that, to me, is what I thought about when I was studying about woman wisdom. Because where is the woman wisdom? She's right there in the marketplaces, in the streets, on the corner with the immoral woman. And so I think of my dad on the corner of Bourbon Street with Lily the cat Christine. Well, the picture of Lily the cat Christine. Because you... wisdom is in the midst of all the nitty-gritty of life, and it's in the midst of everything we think we should avoid and block out. It's right there, but it's the choices for destruction, for sowing the seeds that will cause destruction for our children, or in knowing it's there but making different choices. And, you know, Solomon just made some really poor choices.
Well, I have a daddy story as well. I grew up in southern Arkansas, and my dad was the band director. It was a very small town. They were about 3,500 people, including the dogs. And we were very typical. Sorry. You got that, huh? we were very typical small southern town, and that we had railroad tracks, you know, that kind of went through the town and divided us. And the whites lived on one side of the tracks typically, and the blacks on the other side. And the town actually was majority black, and the whites were in the minority. And so there were lots of, I mean, the racial overtones were real. And I grew up in that. And so I grew up with my classmates and others who would often, you know, talk about those of other races in ways that was very disparaging. But my dad never participated in that. And I mean, this is the early 70s. And I remember there were multiple examples, but I remember one in particular where he modeled in ways, just the way he lived, this idea that he always tried to teach me and my sister, which was that you treat everybody decently. You know, you don't pick and choose who gets to be treated decently in life. We're all created by the same God. We're all valuable, and we treat everybody decently. And that was just part of who it meant, what it meant to be a Cassidy. And I remember we would always grow these big gardens in the summers, and all kinds of fruits and vegetables and watermelons and everything. And Dad would gather up, you know, the green beans and the squash and tomatoes and all kinds of stuff. And some of it would disappear. He would take it and put it in bags and he would disappear. And I remember asking Mom, you know, where does Dad go with that? And she goes, well, you should ask him when he gets back. And so what I did, I asked, where do you go? And he said, you know, there's some families that you know don't have all the food they need, and so I take it there. And I was like, well, who are they? Do I know them? And he goes, well, you probably go to school with some of their kids, and he wouldn't tell me who they were, but you know, I learned he was going across the tracks and was giving them out to some of the families of my classmates, who he knew had need, but he wasn't going around talking about it. In fact, I kind of had to drag it out of him. But it was just one of many places in our upbringing where he modeled this sense that you just treat everybody decently.
Bert, I've got a question for you. How'd the game come out between Tulane and Georgia Tech?
Georgia Tech won.
Well,
which was funny because they were taken before the judge that night, and the judge said, "Well, if Tulane wins, I'll drop all the charges." Georgia Tech won, but they never followed up on it. So.
Well, I asked because my own alma mater, Mercer, which is new to the Southeastern Conference, has agreed to play Georgia Tech in 2016. And so all of us are anxiously awaiting that game, you know, having visions of beating Tech in our heads, which, you know, won't happen. But it made me think about that. I had a friend share a bit of wisdom with me when I was in school, and there were a lot of things that landed on my plate all at one time, and I found myself completely overwhelmed. And in that experience and in that time, I was trying to keep up school. I was trying to help out some family with some things, and I was very overwhelmed. And I remember I was talking to, and my health was beginning to suffer a little bit because of all of the overwhelmedness. And so I went and talked with a friend of mine, and who was a mentor, continues to be. And I was telling him about this, and he looked at me and he just said, "Nikki, you can't make A's in everything." And that really has stuck with me, that bit of wisdom. And that's the way that I find that wisdom usually comes to me. It's in things that people say. I think, Bert, you're right. It's in that nitty gritty of life. If you pay attention, if you keep your ears open, and my friend just offered me the bit of wisdom that I desperately needed at that moment, and gave me the freedom to let some things go, to make a few B's, but also empowered me to choose where I was going to do that. Because if I hadn't, everything would have dropped and everything would have fallen. But by giving me that wisdom and courage to let some things go, I was able to hold things together. So I think it comes to us. It can come from anywhere.
But what you notice, though, Nikki, is the wisdom to say, you are not God. You cannot control everything. Right.
Well, as always, it's really great speaking with each of you. I appreciate your stories and your insights, and I hope you have a wonderful evening.
Thanks. Night, David. Thanks. Good night.
Thanks, David.
Find more information about this podcast, as well as videos and teaching resources for this session, at faithelement.net. Subscribe to the Faith Element podcast on iTunes. Faith Element is a service of Faith Lab.